Hello, you're listening to me, Sarah Jackman. Today I'm joined by James Dugleish, partner at City law firm Goodman Derrick, and by Guy Cochran, a senior associate partner at Daniel Watney, a multidisciplinary property consultancy based in London. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us today to discuss the new service charge professional statement, Service Charges in Commercial Property, which was published by the RICS on the 17th of December and due to take effect now in April 2019. Guy, it supersedes earlier service charge codes of practice. Can you explain what status it has?
The new code is a professional statement rather than just a code of practice. As such, it contains mandatory requirements for RICS members and firms dealing with service charge matters.
We've essentially gone from a lower form of guidance, codes of practice, to something with a bit more of a stick. It's been described by the author, main author, Peter Forrester, as a step change rather than a sea change, and I think that's right. It steps it up the order and brings in mandatory elements. It also, the increased status is reflected in the use of the language, which is much more you are advised to and you are urged to you should or you must.
And just tell me a little bit about who the new guidance is relevant to.
The new guidance is relevant to regulated firms and RICS members. It should really apply to anyone who's dealing with service charge matters, irrespective of whether they are a RICS regulated firm or not.
It sets out quite significant guidance relating to management and administration of service charges in commercial property. Can you talk us through what the changes are?
I don't think it's key changes as such. I think it's just more so the weight that is behind the guidance that was in place previously.
The statement breaks down into the following. There are four aims and objectives. There are then nine mandatory requirements, and then 24 core principles and some extensive expanded guidance. It's interesting to note when you really drill down into it that you could say that the nine mandatory requirements were actually largely there in the third edition of the Service Charge Code. They just weren't mandatory. The 24 core principles were largely in the third edition, but the language is now stronger. And the guidance is more extensive to help achieve compliance with the statement. I mean, I think there are one or two points that are worth just sort of dwelling on for a moment. One that may well prove difficult to implement in practice for some people, I don't know, but is the requirement to produce the service charge budgets a month before the beginning of the service charge year, and the requirement to produce the service charge statement, the accounts for the end of the year, and that was within
3 months.
3 months, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's also so that's a kind of a headline point that's perhaps worth dwelling on. There are individual little things such as accountants. There's now reference to accountants that are being used to audit the accounts being independent if they weren't before. But I think if I was to focus in on one place within the statement that's worth looking at, it's the checklist in Appendix A. That if you run through that, if you're looking to try and ensure compliance, that's a really good place to start. Appendix C also gives you some great examples of how to set out the service charge information. And I actually like Appendix D, because for the first time we've got some guidance on how to deal with handover, which really gives some useful pointers and reminders if you're handing over a service charge regime from one owner to another.
And set the scene. What's the rationale behind the changes?
I mean, the changes have been brought in to improve general standards and promote best practice, uniformity, fairness and transparency in the management and administration of service charges in commercial property, especially serving of service charge budgets in advance of the service charge year, whilst also preparing the end of your service charge accounts within a reasonable timeline. Yep. I know that there's lots of other provisions which the statement goes on to discuss. I don't know if James would like to pick those up.
It's been brought in because, as per the words of the author himself, the code is at best simply ignored and at worst positively flouted. So there's been an impetus to bring up the status in order to, as the press release referred to, deal with rogue landlords and managing agents, and to ensure that there is better provision of better management, and that service charges are dealt with in a more professional manner across the board.
Absolutely. And I think that you know, it all comes back to standards of delivery and trying to reduce any causes of disputes, etc.
Okay. Yeah. And why do you think that was? Why was the previous guidance ignored?
I think that because it was guidance and not mandatory, I think that people are prepared to push the envelope and perhaps go a little bit further than what has just been asked of them, and not actually being a mandatory requirement, as in you will face possible prosecution or regulatory reform if indeed you do not adhere to these rules. And I think that is the key with the introduction of the professional statement.
So really giving people the impetus now to get behind it.
Yeah. And I think that on the whole, most people already do follow the guidelines, as it were. So there shouldn't be too much of a shock to the processes internally for organisations.
The code also in a number of places was quite woolly. And so I think landlords and managing agents felt a nervousness of being pinned too hard to the code. I think it sat in the background as a kind of nudge in the direction to which people should go. And the well-run service charge regimes, the sort of complex and sophisticated service charge regimes, I'd probably say largely were in that ballpark, but they weren't prepared to be pinned to it. And I think that was with some good reason.
And what sort of impact do you think the changes will have?
And I think that, you know, obviously the surveyors in this field will need to get to grips with it. Rix expects them to be familiar with it. All those who are involved, if you like, in the architecture of service charge regimes will need to consider how it meshes with their existing service charge setup. But coming back to that reference to it being a step change rather than a sea change, I don't see it as something that's going to create a sort of dramatic change overnight. I think it's going to, for the sophisticated regimes, they will need to have a look at how it meshes with the statement and perhaps make some adjustments. I think on the other side of the coin, you may see more tenants using it, trying to use it as a stick with which to beat landlords. In terms of our other potential impacts, I can well foresee the service charge consultants who are already have been around for a while. On behalf of tenants, they look at service charge demands and statements, and they drill down into them very, very carefully, and they pick them apart, and they quite often will then present a document that can be put to the landlord to say, in short, you shouldn't have charged us for X, Y, and Z. And they quite often work on a sort of no-win, no-fee basis. And I can well see this statement being another tool in their armoury in doing that particular work. I don't think it adds significantly, but I just think it's, as with tenants, I think it's essentially a bit of an extra stick with which potentially to beat landlords and managing agents.
Let's have a little think about enforcement then. What would happen if a client, for example, encouraged a surveyor to ignore the statement?
You very quickly end up in a conflict of interest situation. I mean, there are obviously some areas where you could depart. I mean, you're supposed to stick to the terms of the lease. And beyond that, you know, there are justifiable reasons. I mean, they're not specified, but there is the capacity to depart from it if you have justifiable reasons. But you face the prospect of a surveyor having to comply with the statement and also to adhere to instructions from a client. And if they are totally incompatible, then that's a conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it is very important that, you know, this is been published by the RICS. We are members of the RICS, and a surveyor should educate their client where necessary as to what the professional expectation is. And with that in mind, I'm sure that if you advise the client as to the position and what's expected of you, they wouldn't ask you to go outside of those expectations.
If that situation were to arise, what would be the penalties for non-compliance?
The RICS have stated that there will now be legal and disciplinary consequences for failure to comply to the professional statement. I'd imagine that any penalties will be linked to the severity of the breach and or non-compliance, and no doubt the financial implications endured as a result to the tenants.
Yeah, I mean, I think essentially the first thing that you're going to see if you're looking at enforcement is, in addition to the possibility of a claim of negligence, which was the case if you departed from the code, is disciplinary action. There is reference to it perhaps also having wider legal ramifications. I'm not overly convinced that there are many that I can see that would flow from that. I think that primarily you're going to see potential for a negligence claim and potential for some disciplinary action.
Okay. And how has the industry responded to the changes? Has it been welcomed?
I mean, I was looking at this and asking around. Most of the responses have been pretty neutral. Maybe I'm just asking people who feel pretty comfortable about their setup already. But there's a sense that, fine, it's coming in, we don't anticipate any problems.
Okay. Guy, would you have anything to add to that? What's your sense on the surveying side?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anyone is overly concerned as such, because I think that the guidance which was in place previously was advising surveyors to the same manner in which the new professional statement does, so far as guidance, transparency, timelines, etc. So I think that on the whole, I think that a lot of practices are already have in place structures and processes so that the new professional statement can be implemented quickly. Okay. without cause for concern.
We've seen quite a lot of reform in this area over the last few years. We've now got the mandatory statement. How do you think this area will evolve in the future? Are there any untapped areas left which the RICS needs to regulate on?
I mean, obviously, the codes and practice statements are continually changing. And as we evolve, I think that there will be tweaks that need to be made. But, you know, I think it's a step in the right direction. I think that creating a level playing field, et cetera, is definitely a good thing, and provides security for landlords, for us professionally, and as well as tenants as well. Just that the process is well regulated, and we can avoid any rogue situations whereby people's professional conduct can be called into question.
Yeah. And there's a lead-in period for the guidance. We've got approximately 4 months now until that comes in.
Yeah.
What are you advising people now? How should they be preparing?
Well, I think that within any company who is producing audited accounts, etc., there is obviously an army of back office who is assisting them with preparing audited accounts, the preparation of service charges, etc., etc. And with that in mind, I know that we have already engaged with our accounts team and just reminded them of the necessity to make sure that we are hitting the timelines as per the new professional statement.
And just on the legal side, James, yeah. I mean, how is it feeding through into drafting or any of the advisory work that you're doing?
I mean, I think there's some thought going in as to whether or not you need to consider, say, a dual service charge regime. So if tenants are coming along and saying, well, we need this to be compliant with the statement, and really pushing those angles, and there is a, you know, potential exposure, then how is that dealt with? I don't think it's difficult to mesh the two together, but I think some thought processes need to be go into that. I mean, there's also, I think more generally, as ever with these things, a bit of homework to be done. There's, as I sort of mentioned earlier, it's looking at the statement. How does that fit in with the current regime? Do we need to make any tweaks? And if so, what are they?
Okay. James, Guy, thank you very much indeed for your time. For more information on the new professional statement, see egi.co.uk.